Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Abaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with David Lloyd, industry-leading chief executive and top technology innovation authority. Now, Dave, you've got just a remarkable background. Thank you so much for sharing your deep experiences with our audience.
Thanks, Steve. It's a pleasure to actually be here and be able to speak to you today.
Now, sometimes people consider you sort of an extraordinary CEO because of all the things you do, but because you have so many other things that you do. So can you talk about what drives your passion outside of work?
Well, I think like many of us, it's very hard to fit in everything in your life. And I really break my time between the business where I'm just emotionally invested all the time and my family. And we look for the opportunity to get away, especially my son and I have a passion for snowboarding. And we like to find the time, and the ladies of the house don't quite share that same passion, so they usually take off for a different type of vacation while we're hitting the slopes. And it's a great break, both mentally, and there's a great opportunity to get together with my son, and then my daughter and my wife, we like to travel as well, so we get together for those opportunities to get away, whether it's in Europe or down south and things of that nature. So we try to take as much personal time for the family as we can.
David, I love your answer in terms of what drives your passion outside of work. So what makes you now an unconventional CEO?
Well, it's funny because I think at times when I look at it, I don't think of myself as unconventional, but I would say that my route into the CEO role wasn't as typical as you would see in many companies. As an ex-CTO and having been in that position in many different companies before that, both startup and more mature, I come into the role from a technologist point of view into an organization that, frankly, wasn't, you know, I'm not a sales leader from that standpoint. And I think from my perspective, that's actually given me a great opportunity to understand the business and the value proposition from a very different point of view.
Now, what are the top five unforeseen business challenges, again, because of all the experience you have?
There's been several. We started the business quite some time ago, about 10 years ago, but we really only hit our cadence in the last 5 years. And one of the things we see in the early stages, because in many ways the company was very advanced and very far forward in their thinking, was that we see a very different set of challenges that have arisen. And the top ones that come to mind immediately are, you know, in early stage companies, the solution adoption phase and driving that value proposition can be very difficult. We transitioned rapidly out of the education market, which knew us quite well, into the commercial market. And really helping understand that value proposition is a big challenge. I think also, you know, we see a lot happening around new competitors in the market. I would argue that right now worldwide, in the last 2 to 3 years, we've probably seen 65 companies emerge in different markets that are adjacent to us or in direct competition with us. So innovation is so important within technology, but it also means that there's a lot of innovative companies that are coming onto the market all the time. So it's the ability to also adapt to those types of business challenges. And I think the other thing we see even from a sales decision is actually helping businesses move from a no decision into a positive decision. It's so easy for an organization or an individual within it to stick to the status quo, not rock the boat, and not look for the innovative solutions. And really working with those types of individuals and organizations to understand that that glassy pond should be disrupted. You should be that, you know, pebble dropped in the middle and cause the ripple effects. That can be quite challenging for organizations. And, you know, the business problems that you're trying to solve that come out of that are sometimes not easy to predict. So I think those are the types of things as business challenges that aren't always apparent when you start into a company like ours.
Now, again, because you've built such a successful venture, how do you build successful teams and then execute?
It's chemistry. In the end of the day, is somewhat difficult to actually systematize. I think we were very fortunate that we had a few key executives that were together by the time I took over as CEO, and we had a fairly strong feel for one another and how we thought. I think the other thing that's exceptionally important is diversity in the executive group and overall in the organization as a whole. If you all think the same way from a groupthink point of view, it's really not going to help the business gain a lot of traction moving forward. It's when you have individuals with very different experiences, very different perspectives, that you're really able to take an idea and let the group actually look at that idea and expand on it. I think it's probably one of the things I'm most proud of when I see where we are today. The ability to take a vision or to take an idea, put it into the group environment, and really watch the group morph that into something that the customers can be delighted about.
Now, there's some really hot sort of terminology out there like mobile, social media, and analytics, and I know that you have quite a bit of expertise in the area. So how can businesses leverage these three factors, mobile, social media, and analytics?
It's that, and when we can throw big data, which is the other buzz on top of all of that. I think it's very interesting to look at. From our standpoint, when we look at mobile and social media and analytics, it's the convergence of all those things. We think of them as very separate ideas or topics. But in actual fact, especially with the way that the technology is moving in the mobile environment, social media and analytics just become pieces, as well as the web environment, of someone who's in a mobile state, meaning that they have either their mobile device or tablet or things of that nature. And in fact, even the concept of mobile is changing. What does that really mean anymore to any of us when we have a piece of technology in our pocket that fundamentally allows us to be connected all the time? For us, though, the big opportunity there, too, is that bringing all those pieces together, when we look at it even from an IntelliResponse point of view with our Voices product, really allows us to tap into the intent at top of mind that is an example of how consumers might interact with IntelliResponse's solution in many of our customers. So our ability to pull that all together and pull those various pieces together, I think, is critical. And from that, from a self-service point of view, we see mobile as the key enabler for that. And it's the platform on which everything else is happening right now. If you look at Facebook or any of the major organizations out there today, it's all mobile forward, and that's what everybody's thinking about. So the key is, how do you bring all those pieces together under that mobile environment? And that's what really excites us about the opportunities over the next 1 to 2 years as well, because that's going to become quite powerful.
You've got this remarkable career, as I indicated in the introduction. So based on that, what are your top three career successes and lessons learned useful to the audience?
There's actually been some very interesting lessons learned when I think about that. And we hear about it from time to time. One of the things I've really realized throughout my career is that truly surrounding yourself with people that are different than you, and frankly, especially in senior roles, who are fundamentally much brighter than you in their key areas of expertise, is critical. If you're the smartest person in the room, then your organization has problems. If you have a team in the room where each individual is an expert in their own right, then you have a great opportunity for success. I think the other thing from a CEO's role that I learned, and I learned this actually watching a few other CEOs in my past, was you need to be very focused on the business and not really dependent on the paycheck as the CEO. And that may sound a bit interesting, but what I've found is that when you're really focused and you're not worried about where the next dollar is coming from, either personally or corporately, you make much better, more succinct business decisions. And when you don't have that situation in place, you tend to make very short-term decisions that aren't always in the best interest of yourself or, more importantly, of the organization. So walking into a role like mine and, you know, fundamentally, let's say, needing the next paycheck, you're going to make really, in my opinion, poor decisions that are all based on short-term need versus being able to actually walk into a situation fairly secure and look at the long-term. And I've watched that, not in my recent career, but going back about 10 or 15 years ago. And that was a critical learning for me and something that could have only happened by watching.
Now, can you describe your journey leading to your current role?
It's actually an interesting one. I've been in multiple companies now where my role was primarily chief technology officer, and in many cases ended up owning the customer service environment and customer implementation environment as well. And actually, the tele-response, it was not much different. I was brought in by the CEO at the time, and we had a great working relationship, initially as a CTO, to help take the technology from where it was and really grow it into a platform that could allow the company to be as successful, I guess, as it has now found itself today. And as I went through that process, I almost morphed into somewhat of a COO at the same time because I have a fairly strong operations background. And the opportunity then came up when the CEO decided it was he had an opportunity and he needed to exit. We had worked very closely together, and the board had enough faith in his decision-making as well as mine to provide me the opportunity to take over as CEO. And I made the most of it. I think I've been building my career for the last 10 years towards this goal, and this became the opportunity for me to fundamentally cut my teeth as a CEO and show whether or not I could be successful not only running major parts of an organization, but taking over an entire organization as it relates to the leadership and the vision for the company moving forward. And it's been a very interesting ride for the last 5 years, one that I've absolutely embraced, but I can tell you it's different than any other experience I've had in my career in the past 25 years, and one that I look forward to continuing in.
Now, what do you wish to accomplish in the next 3 years?
Our big opportunity, I believe, is going to be on the growth side. If you look at the statistics around the market for virtual agents and virtual assistants, what you see is a substantial doubling of the market size and opportunity over the next 4 years. We also play a very critical role in the whole knowledge component of an organization as well. So we see ourselves as a combination of a way of taking knowledge from an organization with the overlay of a virtual agent to deliver that back to a consumer from a self-service perspective. For us, though, I think what's quite interesting is for the last 7 or 8 years, I would have said that our capabilities were fundamentally well ahead of the market. And we're seeing indications of that just as you're beginning to see IBM and some of the bigger players start to enter into this market with things they've been working on the last few years. Ourselves and a couple of our competitors have been there for the last 8 to 10 years. And so I think what you're going to see is a quickening in the market and an understanding that's going to grow even more rapidly of the power and the importance of being able to deliver that one right answer to that customer, that ability to engage them, understand the intent of what that consumer is asking about, their banking service from their insurance company or their utility provider, and be able to create an experience where it's almost like you're talking to the best personal live agent within the company, but you're not. You're talking to a virtual agent. I mean, ourselves, we have over 160 customers and all 5 major banks, for example, in Canada. And so this isn't a nascent little piece of technology. We've been able to really demonstrate its importance, and we see that as a massive growing market over the next 2 to 3 years, which is a huge opportunity for us.
Now, things must amaze or surprise you. Can you go into this in more detail?
When I think of amaze or surprise, it's an interesting question, actually, Steve. I think at times what's amazing to me is what actually captures the imagination of a prospective customer. And why I say that is, in many ways, what we do seems like rocket science to many customers. How do you understand intent? But sometimes what actually captures that customer is, for example, on our Voices product, the visualization of hundreds of thousands of conversations that a virtual agent's having and what they pick out of that conversation. Because what we found is, and this goes back to your earlier question, when you start looking at complexity, such as all the data that organizations are dealing with, most customers have very little insight into the data. In fact, less than 1% of it, in most cases, is actually ever analyzed. So when you put something in front of them that actually allows them to visualize all that data that's very complex, in a very simple way. It's amazing the things that they draw out of it. So that actually surprises me, because it's not always the things you think are going to engage or entice a potential customer. It's quite surprising sometimes the different ways they look at what they're being presented. I think it's also, and we talked about this a bit earlier as well, how an idea forms and blossoms within an organization. I've seen that multiple times now, where, you know, we'll take something very small and hand it over to a team of really driven but very diverse people, and it's how they take that small idea and actually make it something real and meaningful, so much bigger than what the original concept was. And to me, I think that's a fantastic thing. It's a great way to engage people, but it's just amazing to see how people can come together and make something and improve on it. It does go back to one of the things I remember from business school, and you can have a really smart person in the room, but if you have five really smart people in the room, they're always, always almost going to outperform the single smartest individual. And I think that was a key learning. And the other thing I think is quite interesting is that, that surprises me too, is sometimes how, almost that concept of willful blindness. I was at a conference speaking last year, and I had about 120 chief marketing officers and VPs of marketing in the room. And we were talking about insight, and I asked by a show of hands just how many people in the room in the last 3 months had actually even looked at search logs, or had anyone in their organization summarize their search logs. And I think one hand went up out of the 120. And then 6 months, I said, and there was a couple more hands. By the time I got to the year point, there was only about 7 or 8 hands up in the room. And I was amazed at that, because what surprises me is we have this information to help engage our customers, make experiences better. And it just amazed me how little we actually take advantage of that data and that information. It's like trying to drive your sports car looking through a rearview mirror, and it's impossible to do. So that also actually just blows me away when I see that, because it's the richness of that information we're really not tapping. And it's there. It's not about adding more. We have a lot that's there today that we don't even consume. And some of it's already in a format we can, yet we don't take advantage of it.
So what will you do next?
Well, from a business perspective, when we look at what the opportunities are, for us, it's really continuing to drive the transformation of the information and data we receive from a consumer in a way that, going back to my previous example, someone can quickly look at it, visualize it, and understand what the intent of the customer is, what products or services they may want to build around that intent for the future, and how they can monetize that engagement or conversation with the customer. We talk all the time about big data, small data. What we capture is actually quite interesting as well, because it's not only what I'll call small data, because it's questioned, but it's unstructured. And from IntelliResponse's point of view, the power of a question is so critical to understanding what's top of mind with a particular customer or consumer, as well as what their intent is. Our ability to let our customers be able to get the insights out of that is, I think, critical for what we're doing next. And we're always going to be pushing on that. We also see the area of the cognitive computing side, which we've been very successful with, especially around the learning component as well, that machine learning, as a further area that we are constantly exploring. One of the reasons for our customers, they can deploy so quickly and they can get such rapid time to value, is because our virtual agents can learn exceptionally fast without an expert in the room. And to us, that's the other area that's going to provide a great opportunity for us and a great opportunity for our partners as well as our customers, because it allows that rapid time to value.
You're at the center of a big ecosystem in many ways because of your thought leadership and your leadership of the company. So being in that sort of position as being acknowledged as this innovating authority, what do you see as the top upcoming disruptive innovations and the investment challenges?
If I look at it from an industry point of view, IntelliResponse itself has been quite fortunate. We've been able to actually drive and grow our company organically. So one of the things that's allowed us to do is follow not only our passion, I think, at allows us to actually look at the market differently and not be beholden to the next level of investment. So from our standpoint, we've had a lot of autonomy in the decisions that we've actually been able to make up till now. The disruptive innovations, from my perspective, and I think we've seen a couple of these in the last few years, is things such as even Siri, for example. Now, I wouldn't specifically look at it as disruptive in a negative sense. It's actually disruptive in a positive sense, because what Siri did, even though Siri suffers from a number of challenges, is it captured the imagination of the end consumer. Because now I could interact with my device, and my device had some fundamental understanding, in this case the iPhone, of what I was trying to accomplish. Oh, you want to set up a calendar invite appointment with Stephen for next week on Wednesday, and I want to perform certain tasks. And what was very powerful about that disruption is the way that the consumer now begins to interact with that device is an expectation they're carrying over to the companies that provide services to them. And there's an expectation that if I can do this with my device, I should be able to do this in my banking environment. I should be able to do this with my wireless provider and other suppliers or providers in my life. And I think that's where the disruption has been interesting from that standpoint. I also think we're going to go through another significant wave over the next 2 to 3 years in how cognitive computing is being applied to that process. As I said earlier, one of the things that we really focused on is how do we take our solution and have it learn rapidly from the different interactions that that virtual agent is having with an end consumer, so that it learns more about what the consumer wants, how to answer the consumer appropriately, and things of that nature. I think you're going to see a rapid increase in the ability for machine learning to really be highly effective. And I think those couple of disruptions have been very positive and will continue to be positive as we drive forward. Even Microsoft now with their newest virtual assistant that you're seeing just a bit in the press right now around Cortana. So you're seeing this happen, and that's going to set an expectation. And it's going to be very disruptive, not specifically only to maybe technology companies out there, but actually to the companies in our environment that provide services, because that's an expectation that's going to be set.
Now, what are the areas of controversy in the areas that you work in your proposed solutions?
It's an interesting question, because I'm not sure it's specifically about controversy itself. I think there's a mind shift, going back to your previous question, Steve, about what consumers expect. And so I think we're going to see a substantial change there in how customers engage. And, you know, I think if there's controversy, it's more about moving expectations. So today, and in the last 10 years or even before that, it's been acceptable for a customer to come into their banking website and say, you know, I'm trying to buy identity theft protection insurance. And all of a sudden they have 800 results pouring back onto their screen. Now imagine that in the mobile environment is completely unusable. And then the thought that consumer now has to spend all that time self-selecting what potentially is the right content or the right answer for their particular need. I think if anything, from a controversial point of view, that's a terrible customer experience, but most organizations won't acknowledge that. But I think the controversy, again, is where is customer experience going and how are we delivering it, and is what we have today represent a great customer experience? And the controversy, if anything, for me is going back and talking about that kind of head-in-the-sand approach. That's a lousy customer experience. That's great when you're trying to do research on, you know, Mayan marriage rituals, and you need to go to Google, and there's thousands of results, and you have to go through a discovery process. But by the time I'm interacting with my bank, my insurance company, my wireless carrier, they already have context. They know why I'm there. There's no excuse for not delivering this really succinct customer experience. So I think if there's any controversy, it's in how we're delivering that today and what status quo is versus what an optimal solution is.
Now, from your extensive speaking, travels, and work, do you have any stories you can share?
You know, when I think about it, I lead a very uninteresting life, perhaps, as I travel around. And The one area I think when I think about that question was, it's funny, in the last, I guess it's been 6 months now, 7 months, I've been on a lot of planes. I do a fair amount of traveling, especially in North America, a little bit in Europe, but more in the North American context. And in the last few months, I've been on the plane 3 times with the same bands. So for Canadian context, Bare Naked Ladies. The band members have been on the plane 3 times. I almost feel like I'm almost a groupie that must be following them around to their particular points. Or in actual fact, my schedule is just really well timed with all their concerts. And so it's kind of funny to step on a plane and go, oh, there's the guys from the Bare Naked Ladies again, and think, gee, I guess I could take in a concert while I'm in San Francisco or while I'm in Austin or somewhere else. So I think that's kind of one of the more interesting stories I've seen out of my travels in the last number of months.
Now, if you were conducting this interview, what kinds of questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
That's a thoughtful question. Let me think about that for a moment. I guess one of the things is who in the end is going to win or lose in let's say, our competitive space? And why? What's going to make the biggest difference? And the reason I think it's relevant is that, again, I think there's so much change that's going on and will go on over the next number of years. And if I were to answer that question, I could be a little selfish about it, but I think the thing that's going to really define the winners and losers in our environment is the level of effort that an organization has to put in to make those solutions effective. What we see today in our competitive environment is that most of the people from smaller organizations up to some of the largest ones, to implement these kind of solutions is very heavy lifting. There's a lot of services that are needed to be put in place. We joke around that a lot of our competitors have to back up a truck of PhDs and literally dump them out to help make these solutions work effectively within today's organization. And what we've really focused on there to be the winner is to make that so lightweight, such a rapid time to value that if you were a major retailer, if you were a major bank, you could actually implement us in a matter of weeks, not months, and be up and running successfully. And so we see that as a key separation of winners or losers in this realm. How quickly can you drive time to value? And that has a direct correlation for the cost of deploying such a solution as well. I think the other thing that I would consider from an interview question is how hard is it really to get started in these kind of technology solutions? As we were speaking about earlier, the whole challenge sometimes is not to shake the tree, not to cause ripples or waves in the pond, because, you know, we've always done search. Everyone does search. And if you want to be about as good as everybody else, I guess you can continue to do that. But then the question becomes, if I want to break out, if I want to be that organization that really provides that compelling customer experience, how hard is it for me to really get started? And if I look at that key question from our standpoint, the answer is it's actually very, very easy, again, going back to the first point, to get lifted and get your customer experience through using virtual agents going very quickly. If you have a solution that doesn't require, you know, very expensive experts that are going to help train this virtual agent, if someone within your credit card division understands how your credit card solutions work, that's as complex as it should be. And that person almost acts as the trainer for the virtual agent. And to me, if you can do that, you can do that rapidly, then that's going to have a big impact on how fast you can get going. And I'll use a couple of examples. When we did the Canadian Olympic Committee site for Beijing Olympics, we literally launched that site in 12 business days in both official languages, covering all the athletes, all the coaches, and all the sports. So, again, our learning technologies and our virtual agents' ability to learn very quickly the many ways a customer may ask questions so they can deliver that one answer about a particular athlete or a particular coach or event was quite compelling. It could be done very quickly. Another great example of that is Kobo. When we worked with Kobo, I mean, their time to value, we launched in approximately 19 business days for their whole e-reader business, providing that critical tier zero support for Kobo. And in their case, we're actually in 12 languages now. So that ability to rapidly put a solution in place is also very important.
Well, David, thank you for sharing so much of your expertise during this interview, and I know your schedule is demanding, and our audience is very fortunate that you came in today to do this interview, so thank you so much.
Well, it's been my pleasure. It's always great to talk a bit about the market and a bit about where our success has been in the last number of years and the path forward. So thank you, Stephen, for taking the time out as well.
Well, we wish you continued success. You've got an amazing career. You're an acknowledged thought leader, technologist, plus chief executive. And I know the world has just get bigger and more at your feet, I think, because of all the talent you have. So I just want to close and say, I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with David Lloyd, industry-leading chief executive and top technology innovation authority.